Well, thank you for joining me for this podcast. And since many of you have been around me quite a lot, or have been listening to me give talks or podcasts or just talk about Jesus for quite a while, you've probably picked up on the fact that I am fascinated by dichotomies, divisions of thought or action into two opposed or opposing parts. And I'm fascinated by how full life and the scriptures are of them, the classic either-or scenarios. But today, on this podcast, I want to prepare you for this. We're going to get a little wild. We're going to be dealing in a trichotomy, an either-or or-or, where either we live in a particular way with regard to this Jesus, or we'll find ourselves constantly tripped up by one of two snares. Sound interesting? Well, let's begin. We'll be starting in chapter 14, verse 22 of Matthew. Here we go. Directly after this, after, just to remind you, his retreat to mourn for his cousin, and after feeding thousands of people with five loaves and two fish, directly after this, Jesus insisted on his disciples getting aboard their boat and going on ahead to the other side, while he himself sent the crowds home. Have you ever noticed how this account, this very famous account of the walking on water, splits itself into different scenes? The disciples on one track, Jesus on another, with the surrounding crowds then kind of thrown in for good measure. Have you ever noticed that? So here we have what I would call scene one. The disciples have sailed away, and Jesus is surrounded by, trying to say goodbye to, all the people he's just fed. I love picturing him in this setting. The men, women, and children press close with their thanks, with a question about his teaching, with the hope of receiving a handshake, a smile from him, maybe even a hug. No matter how many people are around him, he has this marvelous ability to make each and every one the center of his attention. That's scene one. Jesus, the literal center of the universe, individually focusing on the individuals around him. Now, scene two. And when he had sent them away, he went up the hillside quite alone to pray. When it grew late, he was there by himself. And I can't imagine a scene more picturesque or poignant. There he is, high on the hillside, the moon reflecting on the water below, the only sound, the breath of the breeze. The smells of the wildflowers and trees, the rustle of the tall meadow grasses, the sparkle of the stars overhead, the beauty of it all. And what does he do? He prays. He sits in conversation with the Father who is inseparable from himself. He sits amidst a scene of all this nighttime grandeur in the creation that they co-created, and they converse long into the night. Have you ever stopped to ponder the history of this conversational thread? The first recorded words that we get to hear of these two talking together are, "Let us make man in our image." And by the way, they'd already been chatting for eternities before that. Isaiah 6, when Isaiah literally overhears them putting their heads together, "Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?'" And then, of course, there's the infinitudes of conversation that must have led up to the moment when Jesus stepped down from the throne, caught the Father's eye, entered Mary's womb. My friend, are you in a conversation currently with this Jesus, with the Father, with the Holy Spirit? Is there the same sort of history between you? Because I want to remind you of this. Prayer is not a talisman. We don't just sort of loft it up, check the box, and get back to life. It is life, according to Jesus. It's a conversation between us and the Godhead that need never stop. All right, now scene three. When it grew late, he was there by himself, while the boat was by now a long way from the shore, at the mercy of the waves, for the wind was dead against them. So, at the behest of Jesus, out the disciples had sailed, with the sun setting, the darkness dropping, and we can easily imagine their conversation. Like, how about that 5 loaves and 2 fish thing? And they're talking about that, wondering about it, when all of a sudden the wind shifts. The sail goes crazy, and the seas begin to churn with waves and chaos. The sailors in the group begin to take action and precautions. But after a while, even they have no idea what they can do next. They're out of options. The darkened waters are threatening to destroy them. And then comes scene 4, where it all comes together. In the small hours, Jesus went out to them, walking on the water of the lake. Probably, in my opinion, the greatest understatement of a fact in the history of the written word. I mean, look at your Bible at some point. None of the English translations can even bother themselves to put an exclamation point on the end of that sentence. So, here it is. I want to get you excited about it. Because we can imagine the disciples, they've dropped the sail, they have oars out, some of them are bailing water out of the bottom of the boat. But imagine you're one of the oarsmen. You're just rowing with all of your might, and your back is aching with effort, and there's water rising up your shins as the boat fills, and you are scared. And glancing up from your effort and your labor, you just see this speck on the water. Just a speck out in the distance. It's kind of a white color against the darkness of the night. And you get back to rowing, and you're giving it your all, and everyone's shouting at each other, and they're scared, and one person's crying, and you look up again, and the speck is now bigger, closer. You have no idea what it is, and it causes a bit of a pit in your stomach of fear. Like, what is that? And you go back to rowing, and you're doing the best you can, and the wind and the waves are crashing against you, and you look up now, and it is like, holy bleep, because listen, again, in the small hours, Jesus went out to them walking on the waters of the lake. Friends, how can we ever get past this fact? Because listen now to their actual reaction. When the disciples caught sight of him walking on the water, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and screamed with fear. But at once, Jesus spoke to them. "It's all right. It's I myself. Don't be afraid." And by the way, this is my favorite part of this whole narrative, one which I'm sure many of you have heard me talk about before, the voice of Jesus speaking amidst the darkness and the waves. Because what does the Greek actually have him saying? Listen, only this. "Courage, I am. Fear not." Imagine the sound of his voice piercing the night with those words. "Courage, I am. Fear not." Imagine the sound of his voice piercing any day of your life with these words. "Courage, I am. Fear not." Apparently, they are strong enough words, strong enough intonation to make at least 8% of his followers respond, and you'll see what I mean in a moment. "Lord, if it's really you," said Peter, "tell me to come to you on the water." I mean, those are bold words. That's courage. Except, I know Peter. I mean, he has always been my favorite of these 12. And so I think I can speak to the operative thought that's going on in his head right now. Something like, "Oh, that's awesome. I kind of want to do that." Friends, that may be the depth to which this moment has hit my friend Peter. Let's keep reading. "Come on then," replied Jesus. And I've always imagined that Jesus must have been chuckling as he said those words to him. So Peter stepped down from the boat. And think about that moment. Think about him throwing his leg over the gunwale of the boat. And I just imagine him sort of tapping his toe on the water that seems to have some solid feel to it right now. He couldn't have just thrown his legs out. He had to have. It's just a funny scene, but I love it. Peter stepped down from the boat and did walk on the water, making for Jesus. And again, knowing Peter like I do, I think there's every chance that once he was out there, he might have just turned back for a second and said to his friends, hey, you guys should have asked, because this is awesome. But when he saw the fury of the wind, he panicked and began to sink, calling out, Lord, save me! At once, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him, saying, you little faith, what made you lose your nerve like that? Which Jesus obviously is asking him rhetorically, but friends, literally, what was it that made Peter lose his nerve? We're told. It says, the fury of the wind. Then, when they were aboard the boat, the wind dropped. So let's get logical here for a second. The wind had caused Peter to lose his belief. The wind is clearly shown here to be answerable to Jesus. Therefore, Peter had no reason to lose his belief. May I make that logic work for you and for me? Here we go. Okay. Listen. The world all around us shakes our belief in Jesus. But Jesus has already conquered the world. Therefore, we have no reason for doubt or unbelief. Now, the last part of this scene. The whole crew came and knelt down before Jesus, crying, you are indeed the Son of God. Yes, he is, and we're going to come back to that. Let's keep reading. When they had crossed over to the other side of the lake, they landed at Gennesaret. And when the men of that place had recognized him, they sent word to the whole surrounding country and brought all the diseased to him. They implored him to let them touch just the edge of his cloak, and all those who did so were cured. Let me just highlight a few phrases there. The whole surrounding country. All the diseased were brought to him. All those were cured, just the edge of his cloak. Just the edge of his cloak. Like, where have we heard that before? Do you remember? Well, it was back in Matthew chapter 9 with that woman who had the condition of bleeding for 12 years. Do you remember that? And I had never noticed before this week that that woman, suddenly set free of her bondage, had so clearly borne witness that the entire countryside now knows of it. All you have to do is get near him, trust him, touch the edge of his cloak, she'd apparently said to everyone she met. Friends, all we have to do is get near him, trust him, experience his presence. We're meant to be living and telling others. Think about it. Her experience really has been our experience, hasn't it? Isn't this Jesus, the imminent and unbelievable healer? Well, then her testimony is meant to be ours too. I love this moment. All right, let's keep reading. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees from Jerusalem came and asked Jesus, why do your disciples break our ancient tradition and eat their food without washing their hands properly first? And friends, in case it's necessary, in case we need these comments thrown into greater contrast, given the context, here you go. In the last few days and weeks, Jesus has taught vast crowds about the kingdom of heaven, traveled the countryside, fed a vast crowd with next to nothing, walked on water, healed a whole district's worth of ill people. And now, here come the good times gang from Jerusalem, these sort of intrepid scribes and Pharisees, to confront Jesus about washing your hands. Washing your hands. This is the conversation they want to have. But just so we're on the same page, you and I, this is what systematized religion always does to belief. reduces glories to absurdities. We are witnessing here the natural outcome of a human process. I just want you to hear it from me straight. We keep reading. "Tell me," replied Jesus, "why do you break God's commandment through your tradition? For God said, 'Honor thy father and thy mother,' and he that speaketh evil of father or mother, let him die the death. But you say that if a man tells his parents, 'Whatever use I might have been to you is now given to God,' then he owes no further duty to his parents. And so your tradition empties the commandment of God of all its meaning. You hypocrites! Isaiah described you beautifully when he said, 'This people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as their doctrines the precepts of men.'" Boy, do I wish we were in a room together right now, because I would love to have a little group thought exercise with you. But just listening right now, in everything Jesus just said, that was verses 3 through 9 of chapter 15, what do you think is the single most damning phrase he speaks? Like the real crux of what he's getting at? To me, it's in those words of Isaiah, tucked right there in the middle. "But their heart is far from me." And I want you to listen as he continues to bear that out. "Then he called the crowd to him and said, 'Listen and understand this thoroughly. It is not what goes into a man's mouth that makes him common or unclean. It is what comes out of a man's mouth that makes him unclean.' Later, his disciples came to him and said, 'Do you know that the Pharisees are deeply offended by what you said? Every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant will be pulled up by the roots,' returned Jesus. 'Let them alone. They are blind guides, and when one blind man leads another blind man, they will both end up in the ditch.'" "Explain this parable to us," broke in Peter, classic Peter yet again. "Are you still unable to grasp things like this?" replied Jesus. "Don't you see that whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and then out of the body altogether? But the things that come out of a man's mouth come from his heart, and it is they that really make a man unclean. For it is from a man's heart that evil thoughts arise: murder, adultery, lust, theft, perjury, and blasphemy. These are the things which make a man unclean: not eating without washing his hands properly." So, according to Jesus, what is the center of human life and activity? The heart. And can we follow the precepts of men, working from the outside in to perfect ourselves according to human tradition? Clearly, he would say no. So, if the most damning thought, the thought that leads to lip service and vain worship, was a, quote, "heart far from him," what is the most sanctifying thought? Well, isn't it that our hearts, our inner lives, can actually be invaded by this man, and that the center of our lives can become the center of his life? That is the glory of New Testament belief. But is it what we're believing and living? Which, finally, brings me back to where I started this podcast, our trichotomy, today's passage's either or scenario. Are we ready for that? Okay. So either our life, your life, my life, is a daily supernatural experience of walking with Jesus, i.e., walking on the water with him, or it will be ruled by the fear of man and the world, or it will be a lifeless experience of systematic religiosity, i.e., washing our hands a lot. I really believe that these are the only three choices mankind has, and by the way, they are mutually exclusive. So which have you chosen? And if your answer right now in your heart is, "Well, obviously I want Jesus, but, like, you know, sometimes those other two things sort of creep in," well, then I have joyous news for you, my friends. Ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, and you shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it shall be opened. This life can be, and in fact is meant to be, a daily supernatural experience of Jesus. He is the way and the means. The world cannot touch you. A system cannot contain him. He is immeasurable, boundless, unstoppable, unchangeable, and he is attempting to recreate his life in you. So, what do you say? What do you think? Might there be more in this for you? Thanks for listening.